You did a cover of Little Wing on that record.
It was really stupid, but I put the first couple chords of Giant Steps on the beginning.
What's an example of something Hendrix-y that you might play in a jazz setting? Joe Bonamassa, Guthrie Trapp, in the studio, I think, with Andrew Sinwick. Can you give us, for all the rock players out there who have always felt like they haven't developed their jazz chops as well?
Today's episode is sponsored by Gator Cases. Guitarists, like any other musician, value the advantages of proper protection for their gear. Guitars, amps, effects, and accessories all need safe transport and storage. Luckily, Gator's got you covered.
Oz?
Yes?
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
How are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you.
Great to see you.
Thank you.
You started playing guitar in Israel, where you're from. What was it like learning guitar in Israel in the 80s?
It was probably the same as learning guitar anywhere, everywhere. You know what I mean? I don't think there was anything special about it. You know, I grew up on the Beatles, so it was a lot of Beatles music in the house. And then also Israeli pop music. So it was pretty much that. And then it was during the 80s, so a lot of rock, hair metal stuff. But in terms of the just studying, it's just regular stuff that anybody can study today the same way, you know.
Did you feel, though, removed from the scenes that you were interested in, or did you not feel that way?
No, not at all. Actually, the opposite, because at the time, in Israel, the level wasn't that high. Now the level of players, I think all over the world is pretty high, but in Israel is really, really high. At the time, I could have been pretty mediocre, and I was able to work, you know, like do jazz gigs, do recordings even at a young age, you know? So and I played a lot till I moved to New York. I played a lot there. Like I used to do pop gigs, TV gigs, a lot of jazz gigs. So I didn't feel removed at all. I felt like kind of, maybe I was removed from what's happening in the US, but in terms of music, I was playing good stuff, you know?
How did you start to develop a little bit of your jazz vocabulary to go from Beatles to more out there stuff? Was it the electric band, Chick Corea? Is that what kind of got you to expand out a little bit?
Well, what it was is, from some odd reason, my older brother started playing bass when I started playing guitar. So he's 5 years older than me, and he started to play with friends. So somehow he started to bring jazz albums home. Like, you know, like Chick Corea, Kid Jarrett, I don't know, I remember Al Di Meola, McLaughlin, you know. So I somehow started to hear instrumental music. I remember this one George Benson record where he plays Take Five, or like Bobby McFerrin, you know, stuff like that. So I just went to a teacher, because at the time I didn't know what jazz was, but there was those jazz books with jazz chords, you know? So I went to a teacher and he showed me jazz chords, you know?
Wait, so you had to find a book? You knew you were interested in that sound?
So I went to a teacher that was a little more advanced, that was teaching jazz, you know, and that was, teaching jazz was teaching all those, like, jazz chords, you know? You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning, and then I just started to get involved in it, and shortly after I discovered Pat Metheny group. At the time was also like Scofield's, that era with the 80s, still, what's the name of those records? Loud Jazz and the other one, I forgot the name now. Anyhow, that era. And then Chick Corea's first electric band came out. And also Alan Holdsworth, Metal Fatigue. Those were kind of records that, when I heard those, I was like, wow, this is kind of what I want to do. So what happened was, I went to another teacher that was a Berkeley. He was a professional guitar player in Israel.
How'd you find him?
It's not a big place. The people know where to go, you know. There's not there's that many, you know. So I went to him, and he was a great teacher, Berkeley guy. So he's taught me kind of the theory of jazz, of basic jazz. But he was the first one to tell me that, you know, you should listen to more traditional jazz in order to kind of learn the language. So I started to, like, listen to maybe Joe Pass and stuff like that, but it still didn't click because I wanted to play like Pat Metheny, all those guys, and I couldn't. And a few years later, I met some guy that was a bass player that came back from New York to Israel, and he was actually one of those Barry Harris disciples. You know Barry Harris, the piano player?
Yeah.
And he actually taught me the Barry Harris system, and he got me into Charlie Parker, Wes Montgomery, Grant Green, Kenny Burrell, like the more traditional jazz. So that's how I really studied jazz.
What is the Barry Harris system?
And you gotta go to the Barry Harris school. It's pretty much from my understanding, it's pretty much what Charlie Parker and all those guys were thinking when they were playing. It's really good, but it's not for everything.
What's the overview? Can you give an overview of what it is, or is it too
broad? No, it's too broad. You gotta kind of study it. It's not Berklee. It's different.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So Berklee is based on a lot of modes and stuff like that. And they kind of, some of the stuff they kind of invented after somebody was, like Chick Corea was doing a record and go like, oh, this is probably this mode. Barry is a lot more tradition. There's not really modes. There's scales, but it's not as modes based as the Berklee thing, which, to be totally honest, works on one thing. It doesn't work on everything. Now that I'm kind of...
Hey, really quick while I'm on the road, if you want the licks that Oznoy is playing in this interview, head over to my Patreon. You can get them there. Everything's tabbed out, ready to go. All right, let's keep watching the interview.
Wait, so you've said that the first Chick Corea album, the first Electric Band album, is one of your all-time favorite albums.
That one and Still Life Talking by Pat Metheny.
What do you love about that album, or what do you think is important to take away from it?
First of all, the compositions are amazing. And I think, but let's talk about the Pat Metheny Still Life Talking. I think that's Pat when he really had his playing. He has gotten better since, or at least he didn't get worse. It's like he's still the greatest. But that album, the sound, the composition, everything was just unbelievable. And it wasn't anything that I've heard before, too. You know what I mean? It was like his phrasing, the tones, everything. And how he put it on more, not commercial music, but modern sounding albums where the compositions are still really deep and the playing is super deep. But it's very, you can connect with it. So the same thing kind of with the Electric Band, that first album. The playing is unbelievable. Composition is great. And again, I grew up in the 80s. So to me, listening to jazz from the 60s or 50s was still a little hard. You know, you kind of have to grab into something. So you hear those, you know, like more produced records with tunes that, you know, it's more electrified, it's a little easier on the ear, you know? So I think that's what grabbed me. And I don't know, playing there is fantastic.
And would you slow those records down and try pull the licks out of them?
I would try. I never was good at it, but yeah, I tried.
So how did you develop your vocabulary?
I think my vocabulary got developed from playing a lot of bebop, a lot of jazz when I was growing up, and then getting into a lot of blues. Now, I'm not a blues player for sure, but I
You say you're not a jazz player either. So what?
No, I'm a jazz player.
I've heard you in interviews say you don't really consider yourself a jazz player.
No, I'm a jazz player.
You would say you're a jazz player.
I'm
okay.
More of a jazz player than a rock player, let's say, or a blues player. That's for sure. Yeah, but my vocabulary came from bebop, really, from jazz. You know, I call it jazz, but to me, jazz is like bebop. So, you know, I started with Charlie Parker, then Wes Montgomery. And those guys. I was a Wes Montgomery clone. I used to play with my thumb. Like, I used to play really like Wes Montgomery, you know? You know that?
Yeah.
Like, I used to do the whole thing. So, that was kind of my roots, I guess.
And how would you just learn that stuff by ear, by listening to the records?
Yeah, yes.
And you would just be able to pick them out?
Yeah, but I transcribe. At the height of it, when I was maybe plus minus, I was able to put certain Wes Montgomery records and hit play and play the whole record by heart with the record, solos and everything.
And would you understand musically what was happening
moment? That was the whole idea. It's like, I had this one teacher, that guy from the Barry Harris kind of school of music, And he basically was teaching me what's behind the theory behind what supposedly Wes and Charlie Parker and those guys were thinking, you know? So I did learn how it works, you know, like what's behind it. And I was able to really take it apart. And, you know, I would write lines and analyze them. So absolutely, yeah. I think if you don't do that, it's hard to understand what's going on and to actually apply it to your plan. You need to kind of know where it's coming from.
Which part specifically, learning the lines or writing them out, is that the part that you think is really important? Or just
I don't know if
vocabulary?
Writing them is not, it's kind of more of a personal thing. I think learning the vocabulary and understanding where it's coming from, meaning, I don't know, you know, like just it's like from Donna Lee. That's a line from Donna Lee. So you have to understand, okay, it goes over 2-5 to A flat major. What are the scales that you can play on it? What are the chromatic notes that that are involved? What, you know, like you can kind of analyze, and then you go like, okay, he's playing over a mixolydian, then he plays a triad or a diminished chord, all that, you know what I mean? When you understand the way of thinking, then you can kind of do it on your own and develop your own thing, I guess.
And you learned the theory from this one Berkeley teacher that was in Israel that you were studying
with. Yeah, with
the one
Berkeley teacher, and then the Barry Harris method.
The Barry Harris method.
Yeah, and I got to be honest, I still have many holes. And I teach at Berkeley now, and it's kind of funny because I look at the curriculum, and there's a lot of stuff that I don't know that I'm like, oh, cool, let me work on it, you know, which I think is great. But
is that stuff, like, I remember at Berkeley spending a whole semester on harmonic major.
I never, ever knew there's an harmonic major existing till 2 years ago when I started studying.
Is that a beneficial skill? Because to this day, I never use harmonic. I never, maybe I play it, but I never think about it.
I was thinking of starting to practice it.
Really?
I'll let you know.
What do you think you would do with it if you really got under your hands or you don't even know yet?
I don't know. You know what? With scales and stuff like that, the practice is very simple. Like, you practice the scale all over the neck in every key so you know what it is. And then you start to do all these, like, exercises that some of them are kind of boring, but from a lot of those exercises comes real music. So you do, like, all these intervals, like jumping thirds, jumping fourths, jumping fifths. Then you do triads over the scale. Then you do arpeggios. Then you start adding half steps. It's like, it's endless. You can work on it for years, you know? But when you start doing these exercises, then you started to really see what's in the scale and what's actually can happen, you know?
What do you think are your gaps in your playing?
Oh, wow.
Or is that just like something you say, but...
No. I have, because I've, like I don't really know well how to play. Like, I know how to play over modern harmony, but it never clicked to me the same way as more basic, like, you call it bebop harmony. Like stuff that Chick Corea wrote, or like Herbie Hancock, or Wayne Shorter, it's a little harder for me to improvise on that. Not that I can't, it's just not, it doesn't flow the same way, you know? I've been working on it, so.
How do you work on it? Like, when you're trying to figure out a concept or get better at something, what are you doing to try to improve that element?
To me, everything comes out of scale. So you, first of all, you figure out what scales to play on the harmony. And then again, it comes back to the same thing. You know, I don't know, jumping third. That's over the harmonic major, I think, until I just played.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, doing triads over harmonic major, I never tried. Maybe. You know, so it starts to give you all these sounds. So once you start doing that, you know, things start to happen, you know? It's just like everybody's got the certain type of phrasing. And you play pretty automatic when you play, you know? Although it's improvisation, the amount of improvisation that happens for real is not that much, you know? So my stuff works really well over Donna Lee, for example, you know what I mean? Because I've done those kind of things forever. But over more modern harmony, I have to kind of find how to use that. But that's just my own little trip, you know? It doesn't mean that if you listen to me playing on it, you go like, oh, this is awful. It's just like in my head, it doesn't click the same way yet.
You put out a record with a vocalist called Who Gives a Funk.
With a vocalist?
Yeah.
Ozone's. Who
Gives a
Funk? Oh, there was one vocal tune.
There was one vocal tune on it.
Because I have a band called Ozone Squeeze. That's all vocal.
That was a vocal record, yeah. Too. You did a cover of Little Wing on that record, and you really messed with the harmony,
correct,
which I thought was awesome. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to those harmonic changes and kind of what they were, if you remember them?
Yeah, I don't know if I haven't played in a while. What I do, I remember is, you know, there's the famous intro. I never really played. You know?
Yeah.
Like, that's just by
classic
ear.
Yeah.
So there's those chords. So the first thing I thought, because I used to jam this song with a bunch of my friends. Or at gigs, somebody would call it. So I just started to add some harmony and some chord, leading chords. So I don't remember what I did specifically on the recording, but... Oh, I think I did. So here, instead, I played A flat going to G. You know, the like... That Hendrix wouldn't do that, you know. And then there was A minor. So here I played an E6, E minor 6, instead of E minor 7. We can play a major, you know, more like, you know, like a little more, sounds a little more jazzy, I guess. And then here I think I just, either I played B flat minor or maybe I played B flat major. It's like leading chords, you know, to lead to the next chord. Here I did this. Here, I think on the D, I may have played D major. I did this. I did E flat. So I kind of played with the chords a little bit, moved them half a step above and below, or played chords that leads to the next chord, which pretty much comes from jazz at the end of the day, you know? So that's that, and I think I did that was really stupid, but I put the first couple chords of Giant Steps on the beginning of it, which somehow, because there's that line. So I think I harmonized it with a Giant Steps thing, so... Something like that, like... You know?
Yes.
So it's kind of stupid, but it worked.
Wait, so what's the... So you were sitting down with Little Wing,
and you're thinking to yourself... I just re-harmonized it
a little bit. Yeah. But how do you think about doing that? And you sort of just explained it, but in summary, you would be thinking about approaching chords from a half step below or a half step above, and then...
Yeah, a lot of the time I do that. You know, sometimes... Because I, fortunately, till now, I play a lot live. So sometimes when you play live... Because some of the gigs I'll do, I go for stuff. I don't play the same, you know. So I remember just trying different things. Sometimes you improvise and you hear something and you just go for it. It's something that you're not necessarily going to get when you sit at home, you know. So I think from playing it a couple of times live with a bunch of people and maybe having a recording of it and listen to what I did later, it gave me ideas, you know. But again, like this whole... step up, step down kind of stuff, or half a step up, half a step down. It's stuff that a lot of it happened just from playing. It wasn't like, oh, let me do half a step up, half a step down, that'll be hip. It wasn't that. It was just like, it's a part of what I do when I play. So it just somehow happened, you know?
How does Hendrix fit into your playing?
Oh, big time.
Really?
Oh, huge.
When did he come into your life as a player?
Whenever I started to get into blues. So it was like Stevie Ray Vaughan was the big introduction. And then it was Hendrix and I don't know, B.B. King, Freddie King, Albert King, everybody.
And does that slip into your jazz playing too?
Absolutely.
Like, what's an example of something Hendrix-y that you might play in a jazz setting?
Well, I still do this stuff when I play on Changes. That's Hendrix,
yeah.
Pretty much, you know? I do that over Changes when I play over standards a lot. I can do it on anything. I can do it on Giant Steps. Hendrix playing.
And what about Stevie Ray? Like, is there a different thing from Stevie Ray that you've pulled, that you put into your playing?
Stevie Ray was such a deep influence for me, but it's, yeah, but it's a different thing because the thing with Stevie was the tone is something that I always went like, oh my God, that sound. It's like, if I can only play jazz with that tone, you know?
That was what you were thinking listening to Stevie Ray Vaughan was.
Not in the beginning, but yeah. After a while, you know? I still think about that. But with Stevie, it's different. It's like, let's say, you know, I'm not a lick kind of guy. Like, I don't have licks, so I have to think about a thing, a concept, and then it will come. So basically, but there's something, he plays something like this. Something like that, correct?
Yes.
So if I sometimes do it on tunes, whether they're mine or not, where I can go for this and that was fake,
yes.
You know, but adding that into jazz licks, you know? But to me, I don't think about licks. I don't think about it that way at all. It's just one thing, you know? So it's hard to explain, but there's a lot of that approach in my playing mixed with just bebop or whatever you call it, you know?
Right.
That's a good question. I never thought about it. The Hendrix thing I can kind of grab, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this is hard to kind of get, yeah.
Why are you really don't think about licks, and then you said before we sat down, you said, I'll show you anything, but I don't really show licks.
Yeah.
Do you think licks are what is it about licks?
I don't have a problem. Everybody plays licks.
Yeah.
I have licks. It's just that I don't think that way. If you tell me, you go like, hey, can you play, teach me a lick? I was like, I don't know. When things happen, when I improvise or play, then the vocabulary comes out. But I don't have, hey, check out this cool lick with, I don't know, all this fancy shit.
Yeah.
To me, it happens when I improvise, you know? You know, if I tried hard, obviously I can come up with a lick to show you, but it's not how I play, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
You cover Giant Steps, I think, on your last album.
On the jazz album.
On the fun one,
Fun one, yes.
And you kind of, how were you think, like, did you think that you wanted to cover it, and then did you figure out this arrangement for it, or how did that tune come together for it?
Yeah, so first of all, to whoever doesn't know, I'm recording it as a ballad. And I also reharmonize it. So a lot of this stuff happens to me when I play gigs. A lot of this stuff happened from playing gigs. So sometimes I play I'll play a jazz gig with a bunch of people, and you suddenly think about playing a tune slow or fast. Like you try different things. And I don't remember how Giant Steps happened, but I think maybe I messed around at a gig playing it slow, or maybe at home, and it just was like, oh wow, that's kind of sound cool. But it took years. Like I remember I used to play the 55 bar regularly before it was closed in New York. And I used to play sometimes with Patitucci, with John Patitucci and Jeff Dane Watts. So I used to have a bunch of tunes, and I think then we started to play it. I started to play it as a ballad. It was probably like at least 10 years ago, at least. It wasn't Reharm yet, but it was that approach. So then you start playing it live, and you started to go for stuff, and you started to change the chords a little bit, or like the tempo, or, you know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't, sometimes those things don't happen in a day. It's just sometimes it happens during years or months of playing something. So I don't have an answer to exactly how it happened. I just remember I started to do it slow, and I liked it, and then I did a lot of, I made Giant Step minor, basically. It's basically major. So I made it minor. I did the, I put minor chords over the major chords. So it gives it a different color. And that, I think, came from somebody told me once that, you know, like that you can kind of change the major, the like you can put minor chords on everything. And because Giant Steps is very, it's got a lot of 2-5-1, it's very mathematical. I tried it, and it took me a little bit of time to kind of make it work. But that's the idea. It's like the harmony, I made it minor, basically. It still sounds like Giant Steps, the melody, but the chords are different. So long answer to, you know, I don't have an actual straight answer of what happened. It's just a lot of things that happen, and eventually it ends up like that.
Why do you feel like it's worth revisiting these tunes and these standards and to keep recording them? Because the tunes are so great. Or
I think it's good to revisit and keep recording them if you have an angle on them, like a new angle or a different angle on them. Otherwise, I don't think it's that important to record them again.
What was the concept behind that record? Because you say all of your records, you don't go into the studio unless you feel like you have a concept. Between that record, Fun One, what was the concept that you went in with?
Well, Fun One is a jazz quartet album. Like, it's a swing, you know? And I've been playing jazz and acoustic jazz my whole life. Even since I moved to New York, I never stopped. My solo album became like this kind of groove-oriented, like electrified kind of stuff mixed with jazz and blues and all that stuff. So they sound more like rock albums in a way than straight ahead jazz. But I always did that, and over the years I developed it. I just never recorded it. So when I had the opportunity to record for Crisscross Records, they're a real straight ahead label, and I thought it would be perfect because I have a lot of tunes that are standards that I've been playing over the years that I have my own little angle on them. So I thought, oh, they'll be cool. So I can do another record like that tomorrow with like 10 more standards. Like, I have a bunch of standards that are over the years, I just found my way, you know what I mean, of playing them. So that's kind of the concept behind it, you know? And I wrote one original tune just because I thought it would be fun, you know, and I wanted something a little groovy.
Do you have a concept now for an album that you're thinking about?
Yeah, I got a couple of things that I'm working on. I don't know what I'll record next, but I would like to do another album, standards album, because I do have a bunch more kind of arrangements for standards that I think are really cool. That actually I've been playing regularly, I just haven't recorded yet. I've been doing a lot of organ trio stuff. So I wanted to do at some point, maybe an organ trio album. Again, more groove oriented than straight ahead. There's a friend of mine is a really great arranger that started to arrange some of my tunes for big band. And we did a couple of gigs be like that. So I don't know, maybe at some point if I can, I'll record a big band album with my tunes. I don't know, it's just stuff to think about.
Do you feel like when you play at the Bitter End with like Joe Bonamassa, mm-hmm. or you play with Guthrie Trapp, mm-hmm. or whoever else, do you find yourself catering what you do on the guitar to other players, or do you say when I'm on stage with Joe Bonamassa, I'm gonna be myself and he's gonna be Joe? Or like in those settings, does your playing change and evolve to fit the scene?
Good question. A little bit. I think the thing that changes the most is, you know, I'm not going to... If I play with Joe, for example, you have to play music that fits everybody. You know, so I'm not going to bring like some heavy...
No rearm of Giant Steps on that gig.
Not really. Same with Gautry or whoever. So you got to kind of bring stuff that will work for both of us, you know? So we play stuff that harmonically is simpler, obviously. And then in terms of my plan, I think it stays the same. I do get influenced by the other players, so maybe I'm not going to go super out or jazzy at that gig. I don't know. It depends on the situation. But yeah, it does affect it definitely affects the material that we play, but I think it does affect my playing too. Yeah.
You know what song I loved on the Triple Play album that you put out was Zigzag, the opening
Zigzag,
tune.
Zigzag, yeah.
And almost that opening riff almost sounds like the Meters or like Sissy Strut.
That's like my Sissy Strut.
Is that what you were thinking of when you wrote that tune?
Probably.
Can you play a little bit of that, or do you remember that tune?
You're talking about.
Yeah. Yes.
And then the melody is. It's like the Funky Meters, really.
Yes. Is that what you thought of when you wrote that?
So when I did the Who Gives a Funk album, that's from Who Gives a Funk, I wanted to do like a kind of like a soul R&B funk record. No, nothing's fancy, you know what I mean, harmonically or any super fancy like jazzy lines. So I actually succeed, I think, you know, it's pretty straight up, you know, in a way.
I love that tune.
Thank you.
When you were going up playing the high parts, to me that's so almost silly, but it's funny. Like, is that what you were going for? Like,
no,
try
on the recording, I did a question and answer.
Yeah.
So it was come from different side every time. But when I played live, I just go for it on the guitar.
For it up there.
Yeah.
How do you record your guitar when you go into the studio? Do you have a method that you've zoomed in on over the years, or
no,
is it
different? I never figured it out quite right.
But so what do? Do you bring your two rock amp?
I bring usually 2 to 3 amps. I bring like, for example, when I did Fun One, this last jazz album, believe it or not, I brought my Marshall, my two rock to play a jazz record, you know. So, but you know, I play clean, so they just have really clean tones, you know. And you put a 57 and a Royer on each amp, and you put 2 room mics. That's it. And I think that's actually how I've done all my albums. Normally, there's a Marshall and a Tool Rock involved. Sometimes there's a Fender amp, old Fender amp involved. I think that's it. Yeah, I think most of my albums are recorded the same way.
You don't do you do you obsess over it, or you just say, "And
I don't have
throw
the
it on.
I don't have the I wish I could. I don't have the budget to obsess about stuff. It's like when you do the records, like the way I do my records, you don't have a big budget. So you have to, the records I've done, my electric records, I would do in 2 to 3 days. So you're talking about recording, if you do it in 2 days, you record, let's say, 4 tunes a day. If you do it in 3 days, it's maybe 3 tunes a day. But let's say 4 tunes a day, that's after you play with the band for a long time and everything's really tight. So you just go in and you do a lot of takes, and then I choose the takes later. But I don't have the time to sit for hours and listen to my amp and the mics and stuff. I put it in, I go like, okay, this is why we usually set up the amp. The engineer put the mics. If it sounds close enough, I just go with it, because we have to, there's no budget to fuck around.
Right,
you know what I mean? And with the Crisscross album, Fun One, it was supposed to be done all in 1 day. I actually switched it to a day and a half, but it's like 8 tunes in a day. There's no way, you know. It ended up being like 9 tunes in a day and a half, but it's still a lot of songs to play really quick.
So when you were just in the studio, I think, with Andrew Sinewick recording a record...
One day, 2 takes each song.
Do you learn it? Because he spends so much time in the studio. Is there anything you observe about how he operates in the studio that you took away?
I wish I did, but not on this album, because he called me and he goes, hey, man, because we did a couple of gigs together. It was funny. He's like, hey, you want to do a record together? I was like, I don't have any music or anything, but if you want to do something, I'll do it with you, you know? So he put everything together. I brought like maybe three tunes that are old songs that I recorded a long time ago or something. And then we went into a studio for one day. We did a little rehearsal, and then we did one or two nights at the Baked Potato. I can't remember. It was me, Andrew, Marvin Smith Smith, and Hadrian Ferrard. So we played the music before I went to the studio. Yeah, it was two nights. So four shows, I think. Or maybe one night, I can't remember. Two shows. And then the next day we went to the studio literally for one day and we recorded the whole thing in a day.
Why is it worth, I mean, I thought the record was great. Why is it worth doing that? Does that get your chops up in the studio? Does that get your creative juices flowing? Is it just fun to go in the studio?
I think it's fun to do it.
It's just fun to do it.
Yeah, and it's stressful to do this kind of recordings because it's all live. It's like, on that record, it's really all live. I don't think there's been hardly any overdubs or fixes or anything like that. It just takes, you know? I don't know. When the music is good and it's fun to play and you just do it, you don't really think too much about why, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that what motivates you to just keep putting out records? I mean, you have a lot of solo records.
Yeah.
Do you put them out because they create like a cycle for you, then tour and then promote? And
yeah, that's one reason. But the main reason is because I got nothing else to do. What I'll do if I don't do that? Like I got, you know, when even if I wouldn't record a record in a year or two, the way I develop is kind of like I think about the next thing all the time. So it's easy to think about the next thing as in the form of a record. You know what I mean? Okay, the next thing, I want to get into more, I don't know, blues stuff or more straight ahead. So you start to write in that style. You start to play those tunes. And I'm lucky because I can play in New York regularly, you know? So I can really develop what I want to develop. But if I wouldn't do that, I don't know what would I do. You know, it would be weird for me to live a life without a musical meaning, I would say, you know what I mean?
Without a recording.
Yeah, it's not really about the recording aspect of it. It's more about like getting there, you know? And I wrote a lot of tunes over the years just because of that, you know? So it's, I never thought about it. It's like, what would I do if I didn't want to record again?
Well, you could record on other people's albums. You could do more touring on the body of work that you already have.
Yeah, I do that, but I get bored really fast. And when you do tours with your music, I don't get bored when I play my music, but when you do a tour playing stuff that you already recorded, after a while, I'm ready to move on to other things. So that's why I probably have to keep making records, you know?
Can you give us, for all the rock players out there who have always felt like they haven't developed their jazz chops as well as they should, can you give us just a couple places to look to develop it a little more and go a little further with it?
Oof, hard question.
Even if it's just a concept or a couple records to pull licks from or even something to demonstrate, just anything.
Rock guys that want, you know, I got a lot of people that come take lessons that are more like that. I tell everybody, you don't have to be a jazz player, but if you studied jazz or the theory behind jazz, just to understand how it works, you gain a lot from it, because I don't really know any other way to teach modern harmony. So I don't think there's a shortcut there. You know what I mean? But the shortcut is maybe not to be a full-on jazz player, but still to learn the theory behind it. So scales, harmony, you know, like 2-5-1s, minor, major. The thing that I tell a lot of people, actually, now I think about it, is if you learn how to play a 12-bar blues, like the 1-4-5, and then the jazz 12-bar blues, like the Charlie Parker, like Billy's Bounce, for example, then you learn a minor blues. Like, I don't know, Equinox, for example. And then you learn rhythm changes, like Anthropology or Olio or something like that. If you just learn those three forms, those are very basic kind of jazz forms. If you learn just those three forms and you learn how to play on them, that's enough. That covers a lot, you know? So I think that's a
great answer.
Yeah.
How are the kids at Berklee that you're teaching? Do you feel like there is the future of guitar players bright?
There's
or do you
a
go,
bunch of guys. There's that are a bu- scary.
Really?
Oh, God.
Like, and what do you feel like your role is with them? Just to show them some...
My role is to try and steal as much as I can from them.
Yeah. But, like, what are they trying to learn? Or, like, what do they want to learn from you when they come in?
Well, you know, everybody's got their own little, you know, like, tricks or, like, you know, like, approaches. So I show them maybe how I would look at things. But some of those guys, it's like, you know, they already play pretty serious, you know? So I don't know. You just play with them.
Yeah.
That's it.
When you, I'm going back for 1 second to the start of this conversation. Uh-huh. When you first moved to New York, you had a gig with Gavin DeGraw.
Correct.
And you need to trade your hollow body for an acoustic guitar,
mm-hmm.
which meant you were then going to play jazz on your Stratocaster.
Mm-hmm.
That was a pivotal moment for you,
pivotal.
Right?
Yeah.
But isn't that so silly? Because that felt so strange, I guess, at the time, because nobody was doing that,
yeah, now
right?
Everybody's doing it.
But when you look back on it, isn't it funny that that was such a pivotal moment for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, because I never liked playing on hollow bodies, and I used to play on hollow bodies, but it was just like at the time when I was growing up, in Israel especially, and even coming here was still a little bit of that. It was like, I guess, mid-90s now. It was still like, oh, you need to play jazz with that sound, with that kind of guitar, you know? But I never liked those guitars. Even when I played on them for years, it was always felt like that. It was hard for me. So when I was able to get rid of it and play on a Strat, that was great.
Why is that a great guitar for jazz? What do you do with the Strat that you can't do in a hollow body?
I don't think about it as for jazz. I just think about it. It's for me, it's very comfortable to play.
That's it.
Yeah, and that's pretty much it. You know, it's not like, or a Telecaster now, I play a lot. But, you know, there is something to say about hollow bodies, mostly because when you play humbuckers, they're much louder pickups, you know, so... Certain things are just easier to play on a humbucker than on a single coil, you know? But to me, I play not a lot, but I do have a Les Paul that I play a bunch, but to me, it's harder to control a humbucker, so that's why I feel more comfortable with single coil. But, I don't know, it's a personal thing at the end of the day, you know?
Did you ever, we were talking earlier before we started that you subbed some shows... In theater,
oh,
in
Broadway,
the theater,
when
on
I
Broadway,
moved to New York, yeah.
Was that ever of interest for you when you moved here? What shows did you sub on?
Well, I did it because I was looking for work, and a lot of the good players in New York did Broadway now, and did it back then too. So it was a good way to meet people, and it's kind of a professional job to have, you know. I never lasted that long, but I subbed on. What did I say? On Saturday Night Fever, every one of them was very short. Like Hairspray, I learned Little Shop of Horror, Smokey Joe's Cafe. I think, I don't know. I think that was it. Very short-lived experiences.
Yeah. You never went back into it.
No, you know, I would get really frustrated because. I would go in and I would do it, and I would do it well. You know, there wasn't anything wrong. But then there's all those things that are not connected to you directly that happen. Like the show can close, the guy wouldn't sub enough, he wants to get his friends in, the conductor is blah, blah, blah. It's all those little things. And I end up going like, it's not really worth it for me. At the time, I didn't care, but... After a while, I realized, you know, you spend all these, like, 2 weeks learning a show, and then you do a bunch of shows, and that's it. It's kind of... So I gave up on my Broadway career.
Broadway career right there was ended. Yeah. We're wrapping up here with Oznoy. Can you play us out with something? Is there anything you'd be willing to play? A tune you've been working on, or original tune, or something, anything? Your version of a minor blues that you mentioned earlier... Anything.
I can play like all the things you are.
Yeah, let's hear it. Thank you. And you threw the Hendrix thing in there.
I did. I wanted to look at you and go like, hey, see?
I saw you do that. How great was that? You were so great. In a video you did, you were doing these harp harmonics that you said you learned from Eric Johnson, but he personally showed them to
Eric's
you?
Eric's a friend of mine, and we play together sometimes. So he showed me some stuff sometimes. But it's what's his name?
Chet Atkins.
No, it's not Chet.
Lenny Bro,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's why I didn't learn it, but Eric's got some good ones, so he's shown me a couple. I don't remember right now.
But do you even, when you're sitting down with Eric, you'll say, show me something, or just naturally, you'll be singing with guitars?
So I think one time we were playing some, what happened is sometimes, he played on a couple of my records, but if I go to Austin to play, it used to be that you would just come and sit in and play with us a couple of tunes. And then when he plays in New York, he usually invites me and I go and sit in. So I think one time he was playing, maybe it was BB, I forgot where, maybe Sonny Hall or BB King. And he was doing this harmonics on the break. I was like, hey man, what was it? So he showed it to me.
So, and is he a good teacher, or he showed you what he says?
No, he just showed me the thing.
The technique. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you spent a lot of time learning his records?
I listen to his records a lot. I love his stuff.
Yeah.
I never tried to transcribe it, but man, I love his records and his playing. His own,
unbelievable. You
know, nothing like that.
Oz, what's been unsaid? Have we left anything out? Anything? Oz is going on the road with Andrew.
No, nothing.
No.
Oh, yeah.
What are we plugging here? Let's make sure nothing gets unplugged.
Okay, what are we plugging? My new Crisscross album, Fun One. We're plugging that one. That just came out.
That's a great jazz quartet record.
I'm really happy I did it. And then the record I did with Andrew Sunewick just came out, and it's called,
Recreational Substances.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm a little high now. I can't remember. I'm joking.
All of the recreational substances.
Yeah, I'm joking.
You're looking at me for what the record's
called.
You know,
it's really funny. I have a friend of mine, when she saw the name, she called me and she was laughing so hard. She goes like, dude, you never get high ever. And this is the name of the record. I was like, I didn't choose the name.
How have you lived in the same apartment? Is it true you've lived in the same apartment your entire time in New York?
Yeah.
How did you pull that off?
Well, if at the time, I came in the mid-90s, and I found it on the Village Voice.
Yeah.
It's what's called rent-stabilized. So people that have rent-stabilized apartment in New York, if they're good apartments, they just stay. They don't leave. So I got lucky with that, and that's that. There's plenty of people
in
New York. It's not like anything rare. It's just like at the time, there was more of those apartments around. I think there's still some.
Incredible.
You
know, Matt, any questions that we've left down here?
Audience, anything?
Audience, any in-studio audience questions? Osnoy, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah,
it's great to see you. Sounds incredible, too. Wow. I always love watching you play.
Really?
You're always so great to watch play. And I love seeing you sit in with other guys, because I feel like when you sit in with Guthrie or when you sit in with Joe or any of those guys, your playing is always so different and complementary to them.
Actually, you know, this is an interesting topic that you should add this to the thing.
What's the we're still recording.
Okay, still recording. So I'm like the king of sitting in with famous people.
Yeah.
And sitting in on gigs like that is the worst experience.
Wait, what? What do you mean?
Because think about this.
I'm thinking.
I'm going to see Eric Johnson. Eric's playing. He's been shredding and all, like, warmed up for like an hour already with his own amps and everything. And then he calls me to go and play one song, like Impressions or a freaking Cauldron. And I have to, you're not warmed up. You're not playing your own amp. You never did a sound check, nothing. And you have to come and play and kind of like bring it, you know? It's in one hand, it's fun because you're playing with those guys. But on the other hand, it's so stressful. And it's so uncomfortable, and I've been doing it for years. I just did one this last New Year's. A lot of times I will sit in with Warren Hands and Government Mule.
At the Beacon.
Yeah, the Beacon. I do that every year for years. So I always call him. I say, hey, I'm coming down. He goes like, okay, you want to play this tune? I was like, sure. So then this time he goes like, okay, just listen to this one song. And it was a super uber fast tune. And I was like, you motherfucker, you playing here for already 2.5 hours with your amp all warmed up. All you guys are ready to, and I'm jumping in for one song and I have to play super fast tempo.
So why do you do it? Because it is fun?
Because it's what it is. I don't know. It's nothing else to do.
So what do you do? Like I saw you hop in at the bitter end with Guthrie. Guthrie was playing.
Yeah, it's the same. It's all the same. It's always the same. You go in, you sit in with all those guys. They've already been playing for like an hour. They have the sound all tweaked out. They're all warmed up. And then you jump in and you're like, okay, I guess that's all I got now. Like, it would have been probably better if I would play a couple of tunes, but it's usually just one song. I remember the first time I sat in at the Beacon, Warren called me. It was when he was still playing with the Allman Brothers. And I didn't really know the Allman Brothers in Israel. I knew them a little bit when I moved here. So he calls me, and it's him and Derek and, the Allman Brothers. And I come in, and I didn't really know what the fuck I was doing, you know? And he asked me to do Elizabeth Reed.
Yeah.
So first of all, that's not an easy tune. Second of all, I never heard it in my life.
And it's a standard, so everybody knows
exactly.
It.
I never knew, and I jumped in and I played, but I was like...
So what do you do in that circumstance? Do you just listen?
You listen, and I would say one thing. In all those situations, it's mostly very... Once you're on stage, let's say with Warren, for example, it's very chilled. So it's easy to kind of get comfortable. But it's still, it's... They have the advantage, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you love, I feel like every time you're around Nashville guys like Tom Bukovac, they are so enamored with your playing and what you do. And do you feel like there's a different thing between guys who work in Nashville and guys who work in New York? Like Tom Bukovac was like the best guy in Nashville. He was sitting down with you and he was enamored by your theory
I think the thing about all those Nashville guys that like what I do is... It's the fact that I have a lot of bluesy, like a roots in blues and rock, and I have that sound too, or at least I can get those sounds, because I've been doing studio work my whole life too. I'm not like them, but still. But I have all the jazz knowledge, so for them it's easier to grab it because they hear it in a context that it's not like swinging. It's like more over groove music, you know? So it's almost like... We're playing an R&B tune, but I can go for the jazz stuff, you know, so it's easier for them to kind of digest it that way. I think that's why, you know, I'm a little more, as opposed to like a jazz guy that will play jazz all night, they can't grab any of that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right, right.
I think that's what it is. It's either that or my looks.
It's probably both. Oznoy, go listen to the music, catch him on the road. Get into it. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time.
Awesome.
Whew.
Wow, that was good.